Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Isle of Wight show with me, Joe Redstone. Today, I'm talking with Paul Armfield. Paul is the head guy over at the Key Arts Centre in Newport and also a very well-respected musician too. As well as talking about his music, we talk extensively about Paul's role at the Key and also the importance of art centres generally. You'll hear Paul speaking very passionately about why they're important and why we should support them. In addition to that kind of thing, we'll also discuss babysitting Ozzy Osbourne and falling asleep on the job in Bratislava. So do please enjoy my conversation with Paul Armfield. Hello again, everybody. Lovely to be with you again. I'm here today with Paul Armfield, who is the head honcho at the Key Arts in Newport. Paul, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And as ever, the question will be, you know, what's your Isle of Wight story, Paul? How did you end up here and now?
Okay, well, yeah, I moved to the Isle of Wight when I was 10 years old. I came from Birmingham, and I've met several people around the same time. We were about sort of 1977, were moving down from the Midlands. Doctors were advising people with asthma to come and live by the sea. And my family were always coming down here on holiday, and so we moved.
Yeah. Okay. And how did you find that? Because obviously, a change from somewhere like Birmingham to somewhere like the Isle of Wight, that's quite a big change.
It's a big change. The main thing that I experienced immediately was community. I lived in Birmingham, I didn't belong to any sort of social clubs or anything. I went to school, I'd go on my bike and bump into people, and other people and play, you'd play in the streets. I came down here, the first night I was here, I got taken to Ventnor Youth Club by some friends of my father's, and I could not believe such a thing existed. I couldn't, I had the time of my life. It was an absolute revelation. So there was that element. There was also the other thing that was really interesting and fascinating, I think in hindsight was fascinating, is that in Birmingham I was the youngest in the class. And would have been coming up to my 11 plus and would have, ended up on the dump heap pretty much, because I was always the bottom of the class. I was always no good at anything, And I moved down to the Isle of Wight. The first lesson we did at Ventnor Middle School, I was top of the class. It was a spelling test. I was top of the class. I'd never been top of the class in anything. And all that had happened, I hadn't realised this at the time, I'd gone from being the youngest in the class to one of the oldest. The year structure had changed slightly. So absolutely fascinating that suddenly I had this confidence, and another chance, a second chance, and as a result did okay. Did certainly better than I would have done had I stayed in the Midlands, I think, yeah.
Okay, and that's an interesting thing, because confidence and the way that works for different people is something that fascinates me. So is there an obvious place in your life where you think that's made a big impact, other than obviously that spelling test that you did?
The confidence
that you got from
absolutely
that shift.
In everything. I mean, from that you can you can measure my life in two parts. From to some extent, from that those 2 days that arriving on the Friday, going to the youth club on the Friday night, to that class on the Monday morning. That, it was life-changing, absolutely life-changing, let alone the fact that, having the sea there and the beach, and I've written a song about it before, it was the same time as skateboarding came around for the first time, having a skateboard in Ventnor, you can just imagine, it was just bliss, it was like snakes and ladders, with all the steps and everything in Ventnor, it was just brilliant, and, wake up in the morning, the skateboards were no good then, you'd sit on your bum, go down the hill, and be on the beach and then sort of crawl back at the end of the day. Not only that, but, I was working from the age of 12, the hotels and stuff, so would I have had that opportunity in Birmingham? Probably not,
That's a different one. Mm. And so when you say working, were you doing, like a lot of us did, sort of pot washing the kitchens, or were
no,
you a very
portering.
Early starter?
Porter. I was a hotel porter. At the Royal Hotel, I'll have you know. So I started off doing coffees after dinner coffees, and just stayed there, for probably about 8 years, I think. Yeah.
And I think outside of the key, one of the things that most people will know you for is your music.
Yeah,
obviously. Where does that enter the story? Were you already playing when you moved to the island, or
no,
does that
no,
come later?
Yes, I had a guitar. I'd had guitar lessons in Birmingham, but given up on that a long time ago, and had a guitar on top of the wardrobe with about two strings on. And then when I was about 12, I had some friends in Ventnor, Neil Roberts and Nigel Malkin, and we just decided to form a band. It was that, you know, we were in the enthrall of punk, you know, and it was this sort of mysterious, magical force that had really gripped us. And, you know, just the sight of, you know, we had these holy grails of singles we all wanted, you know, and there was a smell and everything to them, you know, the whole mystique of music at that point. And my father was a massive music fan, so there was always music in the house, and he had very good and eclectic tastes, and never, you know, was always allowed me to play his records, and that's all I did. I used to draw and play records, that's for years, you know. Anyway, so we decided to form a band, and we did it the right way around. You know, we had the name first, which was Brain Explosion, I think, for a while, which was a good name. Then we had the name, and then we decided what instruments we were going to play. And I was a fan of all the cool people in the punk bands, Paul Simonon in The Clash and Jean-Jacques Burnel in The Stranglers. You know, they're all the coolest people. So I went for plump for bass. And partly because I had this guitar with just like three strings on top of the wardrobe, and I'd started picking out tunes, you know, on those strings. And so, yeah, no bass. And so my parents bought me probably the worst bass you could ever buy anyone. It had an action that just, I had real, not just indentations, but scars across, you know, deep scars, like trenches across the tops of my fingers. Where the strings would fit into, so it was horrible. And then eventually, yeah, so we formed a band, and then had a little amp and stuff, and I was playing French horn at school, and that sort of went out the window because, you know, it wasn't the sort of music I wanted to be playing. And I'd had some horrible experiences with playing the French horn in orchestras on the island. Just really, I didn't get it at all. I had some really upsetting experiences. So yeah, it was the bass for me, and playing with my mates and rehearsing down Ventnor Youth Club. Again, you know, what a central role that played in my life at those ages. So and then, yeah, so we formed a band. We were gigging. I mean, we were gigging, you know. I wasn't even at high school, so it was middle school. I remember doing our first gigs. The other two had gone up to high school, so they would have been 13, I'd have been 12. Yeah, and we did our first gigs, and then I left them shortly after and formed another band, because I was getting more into things like The Cure and stuff, and formed another band with Mark Wozencroft and Nigel Howell, windsurfing champion, and Mark Wozencroft, as you know, with Bobby I Can Fly later. And then we had a band called Family of Noise for a few years, and then that became that sort of, I left them to form Bobby I Can Fly, and yeah, it's like just this sort of,
gotcha.
Yeah.
So you said you starting out like as a punk band, I
yeah.
think probably, you know, the material that you produce these days is a fair distance away from that. Where does that come from, that change of style?
I've always had a very eclectic taste, but I just, you know, the music, I found my voice at quite a late age, really. Although I was singing in bands before, you know, it was not very good. And then when I moved away from the island, I eventually went to university a bit later than most, and then hated that, and then ended up in Slovakia, where I lived for a few years. And then when I came back, it wasn't until I was about 31, I suppose, it would have been my 30s that I really started seriously sort of considering writing songs, I suppose, and singing them and recording them. And found my voice, and you know, that comes from loads of stuff, really. It comes from, yeah, I don't know, listen.
You
yeah.
mentioned your dad's record collection. It seems that is often quite a quite a key stage for a lot of people. Was that important to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my early taste came from that. And he got this very, he had a box full of singles, none of them with covers on, you know, all with initials scrawled on them, and they were all great old rock and roll records. You know, there were odd things in there. There were Beatles things in there. There was Dylan was in there. There was all sorts, and he got a record collection of albums. You know, that were again early rock and roll. In fact, I uncovered the other day the first present my mother gave my father, which was the Beatles' first album, and she ordered it before it came out, and it's the first pressing, and it is actually the first pressing, and they sell for, you know, I think it sells for about 700. The mono version, which we've got, but it's in terrible condition, you know, because he never looked after his records, he just enjoyed them. So we've got those, got a load of old 78s as well in there, and plus things like, you know, bizarre things that just happened in our life, like my uncle played in folk bands, so there's an element of that in there, and then there's also that series of circumstances ended up that there was a connection with Black Sabbath as well when we were in Birmingham. So I ended up going and watching them rehearsing, and they would take me out to the fairground and stuff. And we'd sort of babysit for Ozzy Osbourne and his house and stuff like that. So yeah, there was a lot of Black Sabbath in there as well. So yeah, just a funny Elton John, a strange eclectic mix of things that I would listen to.
Again, that is an eclectic mix, but I'm guessing apart from the Dylan, I'm still not feeling a huge amount in there that I feel would necessarily directly reflect where you're at now. Would you agree with that?
I don't know. I'm not sure, because some of the things that are, you know, there was. I don't know. I think it's all gone in and it comes out somewhere along the line. So one of the records that I really loved of Black Sabbath, well, you know, as well, the subject that was Changes. I thought that was a great record. You know, it's a beautiful slow ballad, and you know that you can hear some of that in what I do. There's an eclectic instrumentalism on some of the Elton John stuff, and the lyrics on the Elton John stuff definitely probably was a big influence, because I remember, you know, having such vivid mental images of those songs that were surreal and. You know, a lot of the references I only picked up when I was older, but, you know, there's some amazing lyrics that Bernie Taupin wrote, you know, that's definitely had an influence. I think, you know, there's all sorts of things I think that are filtered through. Somewhere along the line.
Yeah, it's all gone into the pot and something else has come out the other end. What about people? You've mentioned a few school friends that, you know, you're still making music with these days. Was there maybe an older musician anywhere who had a big influence on you? Anything like that?
We had a music teacher at Venner Middle School called Tom Cochran. He was Tom Cochran, yes, not Cochran. And he was, you know, he was always very encouraging, as was Mrs. Potts, whose first name I don't know, bizarrely, but I should do. Mrs. Potts, she's still around, you know, I see her, Nick Potts' mother, and I see her, and she was, you know, very encouraging at middle school. She was very, very angry with me when I stopped playing the French horn and started playing double bass. I remember that. But Miss Gorka was quite the opposite, and was, you know, quite encouraging. About, you know, trying to teach me some rock and roll bass lines, even though he didn't have a clue. You know, he tried, and was just encouraging. So, yeah, I think there was, you know, the teachers that sort of inspired me at school were generally tended to be sort of the arts teachers, the English teachers, you know.
And there's a big thing that you mentioned in passing just now that I had no idea about, which is Slovakia. So where does that enter the story?
That enters the story. I went because when Bobby Ock and Fly split up, when I left school, Bobby Ock and Fly were, you know, a sort of going concern, and I thought, well, I've got to give this a shot, you know. So I didn't go to university. I would have probably gone to art school That would have been the course that was lined up for me, if you like. But Bobby Ock and Fly were doing things, so I stayed behind. And one way or another, I ended up, you know, getting a job working as a bank nurse with mental health services, and then ended up working for social services at a day centre in Ventnor, mental health day centre. And from there, they were sort of encouraging me to go and do social work. So my life had just taken this complete, just veer to the left. And I thought, actually, you know, I wasn't necessarily very happy. And I think probably because I wasn't doing much in the way of music or anything much creative in the way of music. And I'd veered down this path and then ended up going to university to do communication in Bournemouth. And I did the first year and hated it. I went back for a second year to convince myself that I should be doing it. And after the first term, I thought, I can't bear this. This is not me at all. I'm not in a happy place. And a friend of mine, an old school friend, Bruce Howell, had just gone and got a job teaching English it was Czechoslovakia then. And he was having a great time. And I remember I came home absolutely at my wit's end. Came back from Bournemouth to Holloway, at my wit's end. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I really did not know. You know, it was that nadir of my life. Absolute, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then this letter arrived and I just wrote back to him and said, can you get me a job? And he said, yeah. And they just had a revolution. It was an exciting time. He got me a job in Bratislava. And it was the most exciting thing. It was a Soviet state. It was exciting. It was an ugly town. It was a beautiful town. It was a really optimistic time for them. It was and it was a new start for them. It was a new start for me. It was just the perfect combination. I spent a very, very happy 2 years there. And
just to jump in there, just for my own kind of understanding here, my history in that part of the world is pretty poor, but you're talking so post-revolution but before kind of the wall coming down and all that.
No, it was after
stuff.
The war. It was after the war. Okay. So the war came down, didn't it, in 89. Yeah, so this was shortly after that. It would have been 1991.
Okay.
I went and but obviously, you know, things were happening shortly after that. It was a quick succession of things. And actually, before even the wall came down, I think it was one of the things that led to the wall coming down were people were coming through the Czech Republic and getting, there was, I can't remember exactly what happened, but they were coming through the Czech Republic because and getting Germans were coming in. I can't remember how it was working. Anyway, it was a bizarre thing. They were getting out through the Czech Republic, and there were just roads and roads chock-a-block with abandoned Trabants, you know, the cars, the old Trabbies. It was a really exciting time. And in terms of music, you're going to talk about music. One thing I realised there that music had changed the face of things there completely. The first thing I saw when arriving in Prague. Like I say, it was Czechoslovakia then, so they were all part of the same thing. Went to Prague, was the John Lennon Wall, and as soon as the revolution happened, this wall became this graffiti wall with this big picture of John Lennon and everybody writing on it, and it was just, you know, it was sort of not on the tourist track, but it was, you know, it was a really important thing. And you realise that generation that had made the changes, they had grown up listening to the Beatles. And almost to a man, you know, it was almost those hippie ideals that sort of smuggled in under the radar on the music, you know. And not only that, then you also realise that President Havel, who was the president that was almost, you know, everybody loved and was elected straight after the revolution, was had been imprisoned. He was helping musicians to make music, revolutionary music in the time. One of the first things he did in his appointment as premier was to appoint Frank Zappa as their cultural ambassador. and the Americans said no, you know, over our dead body. Not, you know, you yeah. do that, you'll see how good that does you. And so he was then ever after was just an unofficial title for Frank Zappa, cultural ambassador to Czechoslovakia.
You were teaching out there,
yeah.
But you were playing as well.
No, I wasn't playing at this point. Like I'd say, my music had really I was doing nothing creatively, musically, and then it's part of the reason I was so miserable, I think. I took a guitar out with me, and in that time I wrote a lot of songs, some of which became my first album. And I was writing a lot of poetry as well, and reading a lot of poetry, and just generally, I was on my own. I had no past, I had no future. I was just living very much for the present. And it was, like I say, a fresh start and refound myself, I think, which is, again, another second chance.
Yeah.
What was it like? I'm trying to imagine what it must have been like at that time, the combination of the sort of turmoil and upheaval, but also the excitement of that. As a, for want of a better expression, as a foreigner in Czechoslovakia at that time, how was that? Were you welcome there?
Or yeah,
was
very
there
much, any sense? Very much welcomed, and I was welcomed very much as an Englishman. One of the things that had happened that was quite surprising is as soon as the war came down, the Americans were straight in with an organisation called Education for Democracy. And to everyone's surprise, they were like, hold on, this looks exactly like the propaganda we've just got rid of. They were wise enough to see it. And so actually, you know, a lot of the schools and everything were specifically looking for English speakers rather than American, even without qualifications, as I was. I was the worst teacher. I went back recently. I had a gig a few years ago in Bratislava, and I went back to my old school, and my head teacher told me something that she never told me at the time. But she went past one of my classes once, and there were glass walls on the classrooms, the windows on the classrooms, and she saw that I was asleep at the desk. And when she walked past, all the students just turned to her and shh, just put their fingers to their mouth to keep quiet. Yeah. So I was a pretty rubbish teacher, but I forged some good relationships with some of the students, some of whom I'm still in touch with, you know. So, kids of their own and everything now and growing up. But it was a really exciting time. And one of the things I loved, there was a lack of choice to some extent. So you went to the supermarkets and you bought what you found. You know, if there was a tin of pineapple there that week, you'd have a tin of pineapple. And then I remember really distinctly coming back to the UK and just being freaked out by the choice. Like, you know, sort of 50 tins of tuna. I was like, oh, I just want tuna.
And so, and what led to the decision to come back to the UK then?
Well, what happened was, I came back after my first year there, I came back for the summer. And I met the person who turned out to be my wife, who was down for the weekend. I bumped into her at the Spyglass. I was there with some friends. She was a friend of friends. She'd come back down from Manchester for her mother's birthday. And then we had a bit of a fling over the weekend. And then she was going back to Manchester to her partner and his kids, who was also her boss. And anyway, I went back down the pub the next weekend, and there she was again. So she'd just literally gone back, packed up her bags and gone back down. Went out for lunch at work, and then went home and packed her bags and came back to the Isle of Wight. And I thought, oh God, you know, this is what have I done? And we just took it from there, really. And so we forged a relationship. I knew that I wasn't ready to be back in the UK and that I needed to be away for a bit. So I went back to Slovakia for another year and had another great time. And then I knew at the end of that was probably, you know, it couldn't last forever. And I wanted to be back in the UK with my, you know, with, like I say, Gina. Then, you know, I came back, pretty much went straight into a job at the bookshop at the Waterstones. It was Otticas as it was then. And got married and had kids. Yeah.
Okay. And then at some point in this story, so you've gone from the teaching, come back to the island and the bookshop, where does the music re-enter the story?
Pretty much about then, because almost as soon as I got back and started working in the bookshop and everything, I'd got some songs, like I said, under my belt, and I started playing music with... So I was playing with music with Chris Phillips and a chap called Nigel Langford and Hugh Stevens. We formed a band called the Peccadillos, and and started doing my own songs then. And also I started playing, recording with Adam Kirk, who at that time was had gone off and his career was really taking off. He was playing guitar with various people, including Joan Baez. So, whenever he came back, he'd got a four-track cassette recorder and we would just start writing songs and demoing them, and with no intention for anything to happen to them. And we just did, and everyone I played them to were like, wow, these are great. And yeah, it was really instrumental in me finding my voice like that. And then, eventually those sort of songs were, the Peccadilloes didn't do anything really. We just had a bit of fun. And then eventually someone heard these recordings and said, oh, you've got a record, we'll make a record, you know, we'll do all this and stuff. So that's basically what happened then. Yeah. And so I sort of had my suspicions about how this was going to turn out. I thought, I'm not sure about this. It does seem a little bit dodgy. So I just made sure, I said, okay, look, if we're going to go and record these things, we had the opportunity to record them at Island Records studio, where Nick Drake had recorded and Bob Marley and everybody. And so I just said, okay, well, if I'm going to go and make a record there and you're going to put the money for this, you know, then these are the people I want to be involved, and I just want to make sure that these people are paid up front. And that's what we did. So we went and I chose Trevor Smith, who... Do you know Trevor?
I was at school with his sister Kate.
Who,
incidentally, let me just drop this one in. Kate recently had her first novel published. It's called The Negligence, and it's awesome. Anyway, back to Trevor.
Trevor, I'd played a holiday camp with when I was at my lowest point, as I was saying earlier. You know, what the only music I was doing was at the holiday camps, and I hated it. But Trevor was my saving grace. You know, we just had a laugh, and he was a wonderful musician, obviously. I said, I want Trevor Smith to play, J.C. Grimshaw, Jake Rodriguez. Whose background in music was completely, you know, unusual, and were coming from somewhere else completely. Trevor, who did orchestral percussion, really, and Barclay Mackay, who had been on the island, you know, I was at school with, but whose piano playing had just gone on to another level. And so the five of us just went into a studio, rehearsed for one day, and then went into the studio for 5 days, and... then I think we had another 4 days in another studio and recorded this first album, and it just got released in Germany, only in Germany. We ended up working with Ian Capel, who had produced some beautiful records that I loved, and then it just got released in Germany. And unbeknownst to me, because I had no idea, you know, the musical landscape in Germany, but you know, it was getting like really big reviews, and you know, sort of, we had a 5-page feature in this magazine. That was like the biggest magazine there, you know, and that was the launch that I've sort of been riding that wave ever since, really. Even though everything subsequently has not been as successful, you know, certainly in terms of the financial success, as I've pulled it closer and closer to home, you know, it's become a more viable prospect. But that initial impetus really launched us over there. But had no impact over here whatsoever, really. The UK's always been a complete mystery to me, really. Bizarrely, considering some of the things that have happened, you know, that the radio plates picked up and things. But yeah, it's strange. One of these days.
Yeah, one of these days. Because you still, you know, even though you're at the Key now, you're still fairly regularly sort of around Europe. I think were you in Italy recently?
I've been in Italy quite a bit in the last few years, And there's, it's written into my... It was always good at one of the things that were the good things that was happening when I was at Otticas and Waterstones, when I was doing my touring, was that I'd always... Because it was changing hands so many times... Whenever I got a new manager, I would tell them, oh, I agreed with the previous manager that I could have 3 weeks off to go touring. And so I played that game several times and got the benefit of that, but always managed to balance it anyway. And then of course I had 3 years where I wasn't doing, I was just doing music, so there wasn't a problem then. And actually, it's in my contract now that I can, that I, you know, it's expected that I will go off touring. So that's acceptable, you know, with previous arrangement. But I'm managing to balance the touring. The creative thing is a slightly different thing because, you know, this takes up all my mental space, this job. So I've done very little writing in since I've been here.
Yeah, and any plans to try and change that in the future?
Well, I'm off recording next month in Stuttgart with a brilliant chap called Max Brown, a great guitarist, and a wonderful producer and a songwriter as well. He's very, very tasteful. I brought him over to the island once with his sister Laura, Max and Laurie Brown, who was so superb, and he has a really lovely studio. So I'm going over to. He's invited me to go and record. So we'll see what comes out of that, really. I'm taking Giulio Cantori, who's a wonderful guitarist and luthier and singer-songwriter, who I met in Italy a couple of years ago and have forged a good friendship. So he's coming as well. We're just going to see what happens. John Thorne was coming, but he's got other things to do. So that's a shame. But it's going to be an interesting... We'll see what comes out of that as to what happens next, yeah. Mm.
And then the Key Arts Centre enters the story.
Yeah.
And you've been here a few years now.
2 years, just over 2 years, yeah.
Yeah. What was it? I thought it was longer than that.
No, it feels like forever.
Yeah. And I mean, what was the motivation for
I love this place. I've loved the Key Arts since I came here when I was at Medina High School. I remember coming to the Key Discos here. I remember coming and seeing a Gerald Scarfe exhibition here and, you know, all sorts of things that it's been a real focal point of my adult life, really, from teenage years, so many things have happened here. I've seen so many great gigs here, so many great exhibitions, had so many nice parties, you know, all sorts of things. And I love the place, you know, really do love the place. And I've known most of the managers, I think, over the last sort of 20 years, probably. And of course, I was as distraught as everyone when, I'd heard that, you know, that it was really on the verge of closure. And of course, then they managed to just pull themselves back from that point. Ian Davidson from Strings was doing a great job of keeping the thing together, you know. I'd been approached by a couple of the trustees as to whether I'd be interested in doing it because I wasn't working at the bookshop. In fact, when I was working at the bookshop, I had thought about applying for a job here and was talked out of it by one of the previous managers. And I think, you know, it's a hard role because, you know, it's a lot of jobs. It's a lot of different jobs. And especially at the moment because, you know, there's such a skeleton staff and, you know, we're trying to claw ourselves back. But anyway, so I couldn't do it. I was in the middle of a big project with my Found project, my album Found. Then I was, you know, I'd committed a lot to that. And then a year later, Ian decided to leave. And they approached me again and said, might I consider applying for the job as a part-time role? So I said, that sounds much more feasible. I would love to, you know. And so I applied and was successful. And of course, immediately it was, you know, it was every waking hour, really. And I suppose I knew it would be. I certainly knew that's what was needed. And it needed somebody who was prepared to do that. It needed somebody who was, I think, knew the island scene, who understood, you know, what was needed for the island, I think. Because I got that from the bookshop, you know, making things have a local resonance, a local relevance, you know, was really what drove the bookshop to be so successful. And so this making that's exactly what I I wanted for this place, and I was prepared to do it, and I certainly, you know, actually was prepared to do it, not begrudgingly at all. And you know, so it's been hard work on everyone's part. You know, everybody has worked very, very hard through some very uncertain times. But actually, you know, I'm pleased to say that you know, we're constantly tweaking as we go, but it's getting to a stage where, you know, it's washing its own face for the first time ever, really, because before it's always had huge amounts of funding. Or, you know, up till about 8 years ago it did, you know. And now, yes, like I say, for the first time, it's starting to build up its reserves, and it's optimistic, and you know, it's going to take a lot to keep that momentum up, and but it's on the right trajectory, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And there are so many good things happening here, and we'll come on to those. Mm. We'll come on to those in a moment. But I am also interested in what, you know, me and anyone listening may or may not be able to contribute. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the big challenges are here at the moment?
The big challenge is the art centres across the world are closing down, you're left, right and centre, because it's hard to sustain. The challenges here are raising finances. You know, we have a very successful cafe now. And that's, you know, really driving it. We do hires, you know, people hire the space for functions, for conferences, for meetings. We've got lots of different spaces where that works, you know, and we do lots of that. Also, people hire it for parties, for weddings, things like that. So that helps, really does help us. You know, that's money that comes in from those is. Helps us put on the arts, because we're an arts centre, we're not a wedding centre, you know, we're an arts centre, and that's why people want to have weddings here, for a start. That's why people want to come here, because it's a great atmosphere. But the challenge for us is obviously is raising enough finances to maintain the building, for one. You know, we've got about 60 grand's worth of pointing that needs to, well, no more than that actually, that needs doing quite urgently, and you know, trying to raise the money for that. You know, there are various funds around, but in terms of funds for charities, that, you know, arts charities are fairly low down on the list. The other challenges that we face, and for, you know, the island, I think, is one of selling ourselves as a whole, I think, the island as a whole, and the Keys playing a really instrumental part in that at the moment, in working together with different agencies across the island, working together with museums, with the AONB, with schools, with all sorts of different agencies across the island, to try and, you know, speak with one voice to some extent, and make, you know, really and there's loads of work that's happening with that, and a lot of it is under the title the Island Collection, which is, you know, sort of, if you like, representing the island as a whole, and it's exciting times, you know, because there really does seem to be a collective voice for once, and it seems to me that you know, like working alongside Ventnor Exchange and the likes, you know, the Art Ecology, Eccleston George, all that, like, you know, all these creative different people on the island, that there is very much a sort of an awareness and a willingness, I think, to promote the island as somewhere that people come to create, where people come to be inspired. You know, it's not necessarily the platform or the theatre to show these things, but it's certainly where people come and have always come to do things, to make things, and to be creative, and to get probably an objective view on things, because I think islands are always like that to some extent, because they are, you know, to the side, and they're separate from, you know, the mainstream and the rat race, that you can actually step aside and consider things with a little bit more of a slightly askew view of the world, and you know, it's different, and like I say, it's a creative place to be. It allows you that freedom to be creative, I think, and you know, the geography of the place, the actual landscape, and just, I think, the community allows that as well for some reason. There's something about it, you know, that's why, you know, Darwin came here and wrote Origin of Species here. You know, I think people don't know that, because they know the final result, they don't know he came here to do it. And I think that, you know, that's something that's worth promoting, you know, that this is somewhere to come and do stuff. And certainly with loads of young creatives at the moment and young startups and young tech companies or whatever, those sort of tech industries, you know, they are coming to locate to the island. They are realising this is, you know, a great place to be, actually. And it's not, you know, it's not a million miles away. It's, you know, it's in commuting distance from London. You know, there's enough going on. And certainly I think there is now. There is enough going on to keep people here. In fact, more so than other places. You know, I'm countlessly being told by people, I wish we could pick you up and move you near us, you know, people on holiday, because they don't have a Key Arts near them.
Yeah. I guess for a lot of us who've spent, you know, the majority of our lives on the island, it's easy to see the smallness of the island, for want of a better expression. It's easy to see that as a negative, but it doesn't have to be, does it? Because it can be a real positive thing as well, the fact that things are condensed and close together.
Absolutely.
Like that.
And you know, it's interesting, you know, whenever... Acoustic Originals, for example, this week, on Monday, you know, there was probably a good 100 people there, a listening audience of about 100 people, respectful, music-loving audience of 100 people, and five great bands, local bands, all playing original music. Now, we could repeat that every night of the week, but the amazing thing is that, you know, because there is enough talent to sort of... We do it every 3 months to ensure that there's a really good programme. But the point is that whenever I get visiting bands down to Acoustic Originals or whatever, they are amazed. Like, you know, you cannot get that sort of audience any night of the week, let alone on a Monday night. You know, you really can't. And it's not, you know, it's not just getting things out of proportion. You will not get a gig like that on a Monday night anywhere. And there's also, you know, then... You know, we have visiting artists like we had Eli West here at the weekend. You know, from Seattle, who's, you know, and the most amazing musician, played with some incredible people, and you know, we got just over 50 people there to see him, and you know, I almost feel apologetic about that when he's here, but you know, actually, the way we laid out the room, it was a full room, and he's saying no, you know, he plays to sort of 3 or 4 people elsewhere, you know, really does. It's obviously not great gigs when that happens, but you know, he's saying, no, this is a really respectable audience, you know, for someone like him. So, you know, we sell ourselves short a lot of the time when actually we don't need to, actually, you know, in terms of things like that. And in terms of the exhibitions we get, there's an assumption that we don't get big exhibitions down to the island, but you know, for example, we've had. Last year, who did we have? We've had all sorts of people, but we've had some of the biggest names in the art world down here.
There was one Richard very Long. Recently that I saw the sculptor who was doing the torsos.
Louise Giblin. Yeah.
You know, it's extraordinary stuff.
But she's from the island. Yeah, she was originally from the island, and she's a gold winner at the Verona Biennale. You know, she's doing amazing things, but Richard Long last year, who came down and created a painting on the wall with, an installation on the wall with mud from the river, he's probably one of the biggest names in the world of art, not just in the UK but in the world of art. Go anywhere, people know Richard Long, you know, and that's a massive coup. So you know, it's always when people say we need to bring. Yeah, well, you can't just bring big artists down for the sake of it. There has to be some, like I said earlier, some local relevance, some local resonance. He came down, he created work with things from outside the building. It was the middle of the walking festival. He makes a lot of his works with walking. So we tied it in with the walking festival. You know, it had a reason to be here. You can't just plonk, you know, you can't just go and get David Hockney and stick him in here because, yeah, great, but why? You know, so I think that's the secret of this place and the secret of its success is it's got to resonate locally. It's got to be here for a reason because people are scared to come into the places like Key Arts, places like bookshops. You know, I had that, even though we were, you know, a high street bookstore, people would not go in there. People were scared. They didn't know what they would find in there. They'd go in there and be scared of seeming thick. You know, and people get that, and people get that in art centres because they're scared that they don't know how to respond, or they'll have the wrong response, or they'll look stupid, you know, and they go in. And I know that feeling, you know, all too well. But that people, especially this building, because you can't see what's in it. There is no big doors, there's no windows, no big windows that you can stare in and see what's going on. People, you know, it takes a big leap to get people in across the threshold. We've got three doors, well, two doors for the most part, but three doors and getting people. You know, not even people generally don't walk past here. For one, we're not really on the way to anywhere except the bargemans. But, you know, getting people through the door is the hardest thing.
Hmm. New people. You are literally 2 minutes walk from the high street.
Yep.
And we've already touched on, you know, the cafe a little bit, but it is, you're also one of the places in the center of Newport where you can come and have a cup of coffee.
Yep.
And some lovely food, and actually it's relatively peaceful and quiet. You're on the river, the ducks are floating around outside. It's a beautiful spot.
It's lovely, and we've treated the acoustics in the cafe now, so it's a nice place to sit. You know, it's not too noisy, it's not canteen like as it you know, it could feel sometimes when it was busy. No, the place is a beautiful place to come. But like I say, for a lot of people, unless they come in for a party or something, the amount of people who come in for other reasons, you know, it's the first time I've been in here. All my life I've been on the Isle of Wight, first time I've been here. Well, isn't it brilliant?
And, yeah, I'm guilty as charged, to be fair, until you know, only a few years ago. The other thing that surprised me a little bit about the exhibitions, for the most part, correct me if I'm wrong, but for the most part they're free.
Yep.
And they're open pretty much all day.
Yep.
And so you just kind of wander in, don't
yeah.
you, and have a look around. And I think you touched on this just now, and I think this is quite an important part of it. Perhaps for a lot of people, if you are coming to see something like this, is the idea, like, you don't have to like it.
No.
You know, you might, and you probably won't, right? The range of things that you guys get in here, some of it will speak to one person and another person will really dislike it.
Absolutely, and that's part of it. And you know, the art has that debate, and that, and, you know, as exactly as you said, as Grayson Perry said, you know, the thing about modern art is you don't have to like it. And you don't, you know, you don't, you can come and say, well, that's a load of rubbish, you know, and fair comment, you know, if because your view is your view. But the having the chance to experience it is one thing, and then to go away and think about it. And, you know, what we try and do is we try and balance that with something that you will find interesting. So one of the things we've been doing, like I say, we've been working with the museums, we've been working with the Islands Heritage Department, the Council's Heritage Department, who have, you know, are sitting on lots of treasures that we're keen, and they're keen to people to see. So, for example, at the moment we've got two exhibitions going in, which will be open this weekend. One of the exhibitions is a touring exhibition. Well, it's not a touring exhibition. It has been elsewhere. It's about the seaside, and it's various contemporary artists' response to the seaside. Not that you would initially know that, because some of the work is obviously like that. The, you know, there's some deconstructed deck chairs and some. Some ice cream sculptures and things, but there are some, you know, paintings of sort of quite urban scenes and things that you would not know that they were necessarily about the seaside. But it's a wonderful exhibition. There's some of the elements of it are challenging, but what we're running alongside it within there, the exhibition, are various artifacts from that have been chosen by the person who's created the exhibition, artifacts from the Council's Heritage Department. So there are some postcards in there. There are some sand paintings with the Allen Bay things of island scenes. There are various other things that have come from their collection that actually, you know, that I think they give the exhibition a depth and another element of interest, and some, like I say, some really locked in local relevance, and some history and something, you know, and actually something else to look at as well as the exhibition itself. So hopefully, you know, that both things service each other. And then in the other exhibition, you know, we always try and have things that there is some sort of connection. Is it Norman Geisch's, his name is, who was It was a wood carver, and he did like figureheads and things for boats, totem poles and all sorts of things. We've got a retrospective of him. He died sadly a couple of years ago, and an island character, and that's in the other gallery. So we've got a really nice, you know, this nice balance. And then downstairs we've got the residue of what's left over from the Pride exhibition that we had on. And again, you know, that was challenging some things, and that was, you know, a mixture of local artists' work with some prize-winning work from a nationally curated exhibition of gay work. And you know, there were some bits that were challenging, and it was, you know, it's good, but there was some really, you know, it was really accessible. And we try and make whatever we do accessible, even when it is high art, you know, there's a door in, if you like, for people.
Yeah. So we've talked about that. We've touched on the cafe. We've talked about the events that you guys ran and the exhibitions. There's the shop as well. But you also ran courses and things as well. And one of the things that I, just for my own kind of knowledge, actually would just like to tie up is, what's the connection between you guys and Jubilee Stores?
Well, Jubilee Stores is part of Key Arts.
So it is all part of the
same thing. Yeah. Fine. Yeah, so Jubilee over at Jubilee Stores, which is the other side of the river further down, that we have various artist studios in there. Nine, I think, artist studios. I think I probably got that wrong. No, nine artist studios, from ceramicists to letterpress printers to printers of all sorts, potters, jewellers, artists, all working down there, with a fully equipped jewellery workshop as well, a fully equipped pottery workshop, and we run loads of different courses down there and workshops, and they're very successful as well. And, you know, we do other things in here as well. We do life drawing in this building, but yeah, all sorts of things that are going on all the time. And we're just about to go into our summer school, which is just starting this week, I think. And there's some brilliant, brilliant courses on that. So yeah, that's really exciting. And it, you know, it provides work for artists across the island.
So there's an awful lot going on. So we'll sort of start wrapping things up now. Just got a couple more questions I want to ask you. But before we leave the key behind, I think I probably know what the answer to this question would be. I'll put kind of links to the website and all that kind of stuff. That'll go in the show notes. But, you know, have you got any kind of last words for the listeners as regards what happens here at the key?
Well, the thing is that if people can... helping us spread the brochures, picking up a pile of brochures and taking them to their local post office or the local shop or whatever, that helps us spread the word as much as anything. And just please take the time to just look and see what's on, because there really is something for everyone. And sometimes even just take a punt on something, because there's going to be, you know, there's a quality to what we're offering, that the programming that we're offering. And just come in is the main thing. Yeah.
Cool. Okay, and so just wrapping a few bits and pieces up, you're obviously very, very kind of closely involved with the key, and that's taken a huge amount of your time at the moment. But what about Paul Armfield as an individual? I mean, have you got any sort of big goals left that maybe you think at some point down the line I'd like to get that done?
I'd like to finish building my shed. I wish I had more time for that. I love working with wood, and I love building stuff. And I really, I'd love more time for so many things, but building things and stuff like that. I'd love more time for that. And I would, you know, to be honest, because although I have, you know, a moderate success, you know, in Europe as a musician. France has been a hard nut to crack. I think I've just got a way in there, but France and the UK, that I've struggled so much to find a platform in the UK, even with the likes of you know, Guy Garvey raving about me, and Lauren Laverne keeps repeatedly mentioning me on her show, and you know, even with that, you know I can't get arrested here. And my lyrics are so... And the thing is, whenever anyone... You know, occasionally I'm playing in Europe and there'll be some English people in the audience and they're like, how do we not know who you are? You know, they love the music, they love the words, and it's just I don't know. There's a lack of a platform in the UK. You know, if you're making the folk music, there's a folk scene there for you, and there's lots of scenes. But there's if you're just making good singer songwriter stuff, unless you have that big initial push, it's very very difficult. But ultimately, yeah, that's what I'd like. If I could just having a little bit more success in the UK as a songwriter would be great, or the States for that matter.
Yeah, that would be a good one. Would be a good one. Cool. Really appreciate your time today, Paul. I got one more question for you, which is how I'm wrapping all my interviews up at the moment, and that is, and you're not allowed to answer the Key Arts Centre to this one. what's the thing on the island that you wish more people would take advantage of? Maybe something that, you know, doesn't quite get the exposure that you think it deserves.
Cool, there's a question. I'd say probably an Ventnor Exchange. You know, a Ventnor Exchange is the art centre that's happening in Ventnor. The thing they do with the Ventnor Fringe and the way they've really made Ventnor something. You know, they've put their mark on, well, they haven't put their mark on it, but what they've done is they've taken what is Ventnor and they've sort of gone with that and made more of it. And that's just brilliant. And they're geniuses down there. They really are. I think, you know, it's just a wonderful thing. And I love Ventnor. You know, I grew up in Ventnor and they really, they just get it. And I think, you know, more power to their elbow.
Excellent.
Plus they have great beers.
And we all know how important that is. Paul, really great chatting to you today. Really,
and you
appreciate
too. Thank you.
You taking the time. Thanks very much. And for those of you listening, the links to everything that we've been speaking about will be in the show notes. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And if you are looking for those show notes, if you're looking for more information about any of the things that Paul and I discussed, then you can find all of that on my website. It's joeredston.com, joeredston, and click on podcast and hopefully it'll all make sense. One last thing before I leave you for today. I'm thinking about season 2, and what I'd like to do is talk to people on the Isle of Wight who have overcome big challenges of some description. Maybe they've lost lots of weight, maybe they had a big career change, perhaps they've dealt with a serious illness or overcome an addiction of some description. Any big challenges. So if you know someone who has dealt with a big challenge and you think they might be interested in talking to me, then I would love to hear from you or them. Contact me via the website, joeredston.com. There's a contact button on there. It's hopefully fairly self-explanatory. And yeah, I'm hoping to hear from you guys with a bit of help on that front. In the meantime, if you're enjoying the show, do please spread the word a little bit. Tell your friends, share it on Facebook or something. Let the world know what we're up to here. And yeah, thank you very much for that. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Cheers.